Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, turning our attention today to the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Scott Craven, UW Emeritus Wildlife Specialist Professor at the UW, UW-Madison, UW Extension, our guest. Great to have him along, as he always comes along on the first Wednesday of the month. And thank you for listening in. If you have a question for him as we go into this fall season, maybe you've noticed some changes going on in wildlife in your area. Maybe you have some questions about wildlife you've seen. Give us a call. Number 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And Scott, good to see you again.
Well, it's great to be back.
We have lots of things that we can talk about today. We've got something new from the National Hunting and Fishing Survey.
Yes, just two or three weeks ago it was announced that this, a lot of people had been waiting for this, and these were the results of the every 5 years survey that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does of the American public to gauge participation in all forms of hunting and fishing, outdoor recreation. And, of course, the fear was, with a decades-long trend in declining hunter numbers, that that might continue. But lo and behold, it went the other direction, which was excellent news. In fact, hunting participation the last one would have been 2005, I think, the 2005 or 2006 survey. Hunting participation up 9%. 6% of the American public over age 16, and with all the emphasis on youth recruitment these days, it's probably a higher percentage than that. And fishing was actually up 11%. So that was pretty cool. 13.7 million hunters, up about a million point two, something like that. And all told, all this outdoor recreation accounted for $145 billion with a B dollars, which is pretty impressive. And I think the most telling thing, and probably the one of the fundamental reasons why this kind of material is so popular with public radio and with the public in general, is that 38% of all Americans were participating in some form of wildlife-related outdoor recreation, from bird watching and feeding to hunting and other activities.
Yeah.
But that's pushing 4 out of 10 people. And when
that's
you consider
great.
The concentration in our cities, that's pretty darn good.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a new study out on cats and wildlife.
Oh, you just couldn't let that go.
No, I wanted to bring that up.
Well, you know, over the years, we've talked many times about the problems created by both feral cats and free-ranging domestic cats. And, well, there's a new study out released by the American Bird Conservancy, but it was a cooperative effort. Actually, the research was done at the University of Georgia in cooperation with the National Geographic Society. And in this case, they focused on actually free-roaming pet cats that were outside a minimum of 5 to 6 hours a day. So the new approach was, they put kitty cams. You know, you can put a camera on just about anything these
right.
days. So they put what they dubbed kitty cams on 60 of these individuals in Georgia and followed them. And the results were enlightening in a couple of ways. First of all, a high percentage of most studies up to this one had reported as prey what the cats brought back and dumped on the kitchen floor or left on the back steps or whatever. And in fact, that proves to be a gross underestimate of what the cats were actually out there hunting and killing. In fact, only about 28% of the prey documented by the cameras was brought home.
Uh-huh.
So that their estimate was about a third of these free-roaming cats were actually killing wildlife. Not all, only a third. That's good news. But the third that were killing were averaging 2.1 kills per week. And some of these studies have gotten into trouble by extrapolating, making wild extrapolations from these sample sizes. But this one certainly supports the notion that millions and millions of small animals, and the prey mostly in this study were lizards, voles, chipmunks, birds, frogs, snakes, and you know, a variety of other small creatures, virtually anything you could think of. And their estimate, including free-ranging cats and an estimated 60 million feral cats in the United States, was something like 4 billion animals a year. Cool. Now, mind you, some of those are pest species, and you know, cats are doing what some people want the cats to do in terms of rodent control and so forth. But there are a lot of birds and other wildlife that we just as soon see out there involved. So take it for what it's worth. We're not trying to stir the pot here, but the bottom line is, as you do with your own cats, Larry,
keep them inside.
Cats belong inside for their own safety and security and for a variety of reasons. So there you have it.
All right. Philip in Green Bay has a question for you. Let's go there. Philip, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I saw a critter earlier this year in Maryland out on I-68. I'm a truck driver. It was black. I was guesstimating probably between 4.5 and 5 foot long, low to the ground, thick legs, very furry, and a long, bushy black tail, and it was pretty much black overall. I have no idea what it was.
Well, it's a pretty flawless description of a big black cat.
Four foot long. I don't. It covered half a traffic lane.
Yeah, but I'm talking not domestic cat here, but you know, the size of what we would be talking about out here is a mountain lion. But there's always been talk about black panthers, and you know, the problem with these animals and what you describe is that certainly sounds like what you saw, but the question becomes, where the heck did it come from? And unfortunately, a lot of these animals are held in captivity as exotic pets, and some of them find their way into the wild. So the origin of what you saw will have to remain unclear, but from the description of the long tail, the black color, the low slung to the ground, and so forth, it certainly sounds like a panther.
Yeah.
So there you have it. But I can't.
Would it have a very bushy black tail? This is what this seemed to have.
Bushy, like maybe kind of like a hairy baseball bat kind of thing, or bushier than that?
Bushier than that.
Like a
foxtail that's bushed out.
Now, okay, so that throws a new wrinkle into the situation. Let's see. So in that case, what are the possibilities there, Larry? I'm not.
Good question.
I'm not thinking about much with a tail like that. We'll give that a little thought. If anything comes to us, we'll come back on with a possibility. But a tail on any of the large cats would be almost kind of a uniform diameter from where it leaves the body to the tip of the tail, rather than thick and bushy like a fox or a skunk or something like that.
So we'll see what some of our listeners might have some ideas, too.
I've seen cats. I've been out on the road for almost 25 years.
Yeah.
So you don't think it was a cat at all of any kind?
It was down low to the ground. The legs were very short.
Oh, okay. Well,
no more than 8 to 10 inches tall.
Oh, and that low and that long, 4 feet.
4 feet at least, if not a little more. It covered at least a half a traffic lane on the interstate.
Wow. No idea. Oh, boy, I wish you'd gotten a picture of that one, Phil.
Short legs, 8 to 10 inches tall, but a half a traffic lane. That's a tricky one. I mean, the animals that generally have short legs and are long, you think of things like otters and whatnot, but their tails aren't that bushy, and they're usually...
The first thing that popped into my mind was maybe a marten or something in that family. But
well,
I don't know how big they get.
Yeah, that's the family an otter would be in, and those could be 4 or 5 feet long, dark, low to the ground, long tail, not really hairy like a fox, but tapered, bigger than the cat's tail. I don't know. That's something in that family of the mustelids or weasels would be low to the ground like that, but I don't know.
Well, somebody else may have some ideas. Thanks for calling, Phil. Stay listening. Anyway, got a bird identification at some point here, Scott, to take a look at on our Facebook page. Well, I remind everybody, you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. We would love to hear from you. And Scott's taking a look at a bird now that looks to be about the size of a dove.
It's on a suet block, so it looks like a flicker, actually.
Yeah, it does look like a flicker.
It looks like a flicker, but it's got a bizarre white pattern on the wings, which is an aberration. I don't call it partial albino or whatever, but you'll see birds all the time that have white feathers in places where you don't expect them. So that is simply an unusually colored flicker from what I can see.
Barbara in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I've been wondering about this for a long time. I don't know if anybody really knows the answer, but I've been wondering if squirrels remember where they buried all those nuts, that they go back to them, you know, in the spring. Or, I mean, over winter.
Well, it's not as much remembering. It partly a little bit, but they can also smell them.
They got a really good nose.
They got a really good nose, and they can smell them and dig them up that way. But the bottom line is they certainly do not find them all. And that's one of the reasons why squirrels are such good reforestation specialists in terms of planting various types of nuts all over the landscape, because they never find them all.
Yeah. But they can actually smell them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Jeff in Shatek, kind of a related topic here. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for calling. Are you there, Jeff? Too bad you're breaking up. And we're not getting you. So his question relates to acorns. And I'm wondering why are acorns so desirable? But acorns are very nutritious.
They're very nutritious, and they're also in good years, depending on whether the red oaks or the white oaks are producing, or both of them. And it seems like, from what I saw up in the Northwoods last week, a tremendous acorn crop, and they're falling very early. So they're very nutritious, a very abundant food source, and they're really a staple. Squirrels, turkeys, deer, a whole host of things use them.
And a long, long, long time ago, they were a staple for people, too.
Mm-hmm.
You made flour and everything out of them. Don and Jackson, it's your turn. Hi, Don.
Hi, guys. I've listened to you for a long time, Larry.
Oh, thanks.
I get around southeast Wisconsin in particular, but I get around the state a lot. As a matter of fact, I was actually Sunday up in the La Crosse area and came back down. One thing I've noticed quite a bit is the poults, the turkey poults.
Yeah.
Was there a second hatch?
Yeah.
Were they affected by the spring weather? What happened there?
I think there was...
your answer off the phone.
Yeah, thanks for calling. I'm sure there were second hatches.
There were second hatches, and there seemed to be lots of broods still running around where the birds are surprisingly small for this time of year, considering the fall turkey season opens, I think, a week from Saturday. On the 15th, along with a number of other seasons, there are going to be some really tiny turkeys out there. So turkey hunters, use your tag judiciously, or you may end up with a turkey a little bit smaller than a chicken. So, yes, there were some very late hatches, and how that played into the spring weather, I'm not altogether sure, but it's clear from the size of the poults that there were some late broods.
Yep, absolutely.
And some late broods of a lot of things. I've got a brood of pheasants around the yard right now, and even the pheasants are only, at best, half-grown at this point.
Oh, wonderful.
So,
well, that's great. I mean,
they'll make it.
They'll make it. Kelly in Madison. Hi. Oops, let's see. Let's find Kelly here. Here she is. Hi, Kelly.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a loon question.
Loon question, okay.
A loon. Every July at the lake that we have a cabin on up north, we see about four or five loons, maybe for a week or so at a time, that look like they're giving flying lessons, where they flutter back and forth across the water and they talk to each other. And normally we only see one or two loons on our lake. Is that what we're seeing?
Well, it may be. Have you seen young loons on the lake in the past? Do they nest on your lake?
No, we do not ever see babies. We just see a bunch of adult-sized loons show up for about a week in July, and they look like they're practicing flying.
Well, the loons always look like they're practicing, for one
yeah.
thing, because they need a long run. They're not the most graceful birds, except swimming. They're fabulous swimmers and divers, but on land they're incredibly awkward, and they avoid land. And even when they're getting airborne or flying, they're pretty awkward as well. But they need a long runway to get going. So that's why smaller ponds and lakes are generally avoided by the loons. They've got to have enough of a landing strip to get airborne. So they run for quite a long distance on the water before they can get airborne. And
why would we see a large group of them every year about the same time practicing? Because they run and then they don't take off, and then they do it again and they don't take off.
Well, there's a couple possibilities. I mean, as summer gets to late summer, the loons do start to gather up in preparation for clearing out for the fall. So that's one of the reasons they gather up on some lakes. But the other issue is that it's possible that you do have some reproduction on the lake that people aren't aware of. Is this a pretty good-sized lake?
No, it's pretty small, actually.
I mean, 100 acres, 200 acres, 500?
No, 25 acres. Small.
That'd be big enough, but.
Well, I mean, they could certainly be on there, but I think if there were a nest, are there quite a few cottages on the lake?
No, there aren't. Not at all. And when the loons do get in the air, they usually have to take a couple circles to clear the trees. So it is a small lake.
Okay, well, then I'm going to go on the assumption then that if there were nests on the lake or if there were young out, that you'd see those little guys. They'd be pretty visible. So
right.
Perhaps that's not the explanation. But it's also possible that they're coming in there because it's a pretty good fish population, and, hey, they're moving in there to do some fishing. And as they flap around and fly around from one side of the lake to the other, it looks like they're practicing, but there's no need for them to be practicing unless they're struggling to get airborne because of the size of the lake or that there were young ones on the lake that you were unaware of.
There you go.
Good. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer. Great to have her answering the phones when you call in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Also, go to my Facebook page. We've had some photos posted already. If you have a photo, a wildlife photo, we'd love to see it. Maybe there's something that you're trying to identify. I haven't been able to do it. If you got a photo, send it along. We'll see what we can do about identifying it. And callers online, but also an email from Tom in Marathon, who said on Labor Day, we were at a park at Cudahy near Lake Michigan, approached a pond in the park, and a great blue heron was standing rather close to a man who was fishing. We got rather close as well. Usually herons spook rather quickly when you approach them, but then we saw the man catch a small fish and toss it to the heron. Apparently this heron had been socialized to be near people and to expect to be fed. I've seen ducks do this, but I never thought I would see it in a blue heron. Does that seem unusual to you?
Well, it's a little unusual, but certainly not unheard of, and there are many birds that can be essentially socialized like that, to be quite tolerant of people. And once food's associated, this is one of the problems we run into with feeding wildlife, mm-hmm. and why it becomes problematic. These animals, no matter what they are, from raccoons and deer to herons and pelicans and eagles and whatnot, quickly learn where an easily attainable food supply is. We think of things in the city like gulls and crows and pigeons in the park and whatnot, but many things that will eat something that we can provide readily. I mean, it would be hard to hand feed a hummingbird, for example, but on the other hand, throwing fish to the eagles, throwing fish to the herons in this case, fish to the pelicans on just about any pier in Florida or Southern California, wherever, is done. And mm-hmm. people find it a curiosity and appealing, so they do it. You know, perhaps in the case of a bird here or there, you know, no harm, no foul. But
yeah,
it's certainly explainable by just providing food, and the birds quickly, or mammals, in the case of feeding the various types of mammals, quickly learn that, hey, free lunch.
Free lunch. There you go. Ruth and Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. I have a comment and then a question. The comment about that black animal that the truck driver saw.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if it wasn't an escaped wolverine.
Well, it could be. It was out west.
It was out in Maryland.
Maryland.
Yeah, right. I'm just thinking that some zoo or some, you know, private private sanctuary or something. Had one?
Well, that's another member of the weasel family that we were talking about. And, you know, we learned a long time ago to never say anything's impossible. And mm-hmm. the problem is when you see animals in the wild that seem, boy, that's just not something I recognize or that seem out of place, very often the explanation does have some human affiliation, whether it's an escaped pet, a released pet, a zoo animal, or something else. I mean, imagine the people in, was it Ohio a couple of years ago when that individual released his collection of exotic animals, and lions, tigers, bears, all sorts of things, or the kangaroo that was picked up on the roadside out in Dodgeville a few years ago here in Wisconsin. Anything is possible, and it's usually traced to some sort of human activity. That's why it makes it so difficult to sometimes figure out what people are seeing.
Yeah. Good thought, though.
Go ahead.
And then my question was, I heard earlier this spring, maybe April, May, that a lot of snowy owls had drifted down into Wisconsin, and because of maybe pressure of the population density. And I'm wondering, whatever happened to them, have you heard anything?
Well, I haven't heard anything lately, and that's usually a winter phenomenon and whatnot when the birds come down due to food shortage and population pressure. And any that survive into the spring would usually return north to the nesting grounds. And those that there's either two choices here. They either simply don't make it here in this environment, or they return north. But they wouldn't be around right now.
There we go. Thank you for calling. Jerry in Beaver Dam, hi.
Hi. I got a story I think the two of you will like. A couple months ago, I was fishing up here on the lake, and it was in the late evening. Well, I hadn't done too good, but the family just a little ways up was doing pretty good business on the bullheads and the like. They'd catch them when the kids would run them back, stick them in a cooler. Now, when the sun went down, they kept on fishing, and just as it was getting full dark, here came this mama raccoon and four little baby bandits trucking along behind her. She went over, opened the cooler, and started passing out fish. The little ones. The little babies went trucking on off with fish in their mouth and one tucked under an arm. Across the road. And a couple hours later, dang, she wasn't back for another helping.
Well, that is a good story, and it supports what we were talking about a moment ago with animals quickly learning where the food is and who's providing it and taking advantage of it. Yeah. Can't blame them for that.
No, she handled that cooler just so beautifully, I swear that she'd done it every night for her life.
Well, she may have done it a few times.
Oh, I'm sure she has. But the father came over as they were packing up a while after the second run. He says, I thought we caught more fish than that. I just didn't have the heart to tell him he'd been ripped off by a master.
Jerry, thanks. Appreciate your call very much. Oh, man. Somebody else mentioned a fisher as a possibility on that animal. I think we did mention fisher earlier.
Well, if it were around here, a dark, long animal with a bushier tail than most mustelids and low to the ground would have been a fisher. But that seems a little
from Maryland.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they were very common even in the days before I left New Hampshire many, many years ago. They were quite common in the New England states, so it's not too much of a stretch, I guess.
Rosalind in Port Washington. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to find out if you could help me with regard to one behavior of hummingbirds, and also such things as they're poking around at thistle feeders. We figured that had something to do with the fact that they do poke into little areas, holes, but they poke around enough so that, and they also hit the window and fell down onto a little ledge underneath the window that we sit by. And a third thing still, how do they make this long journey to wherever they go, and when will they go?
Okay, let's try and take those in reverse order. First of all, in terms of their departure, generally when we've had a frost and flowering plants have been knocked back so their food supply is eliminated, they will clear out. And there's always a lot of concern, or some concern at least, expressed by folks. Gee, when should we take the hummingbird feeders down? We don't want to keep them here too long so that they have trouble with cold weather. And generally speaking, that's not a major concern. The hummingbirds know when it's time to go, along with many other birds, or that all of our migratory species, and they clear out and head south. However, as a good rule of thumb, once we have had a hard freeze, usually by early October, it's about time to think about taking down the hummingbird feeders, and those birds will be leaving if they haven't already. When you stop seeing them around or when there are no flowers, take your hummingbird feeders down. In terms of how do they make that long flight, well, they're very efficient for a small bird, just like any other bird. They put on fat during the course of the summer, pre-migratory preparation, and away they go. And yes, they're incredibly tiny, and their wings beat very fast. Their metabolic rate is incredible, but they are able to use that energy very efficiently and make those flights just like any other bird. They're just smaller. Mm-hmm. And as far as hitting the windows, that's an unfortunate spin-off of our interest in putting feeders of all kinds and so forth where we can see and enjoy the birds. You have to be careful with the reflection. I've had lots of bird hits, seems like more this summer than anything else, in a wide range of species. But we've had lots of bright, sunny weather, and as I look at those window reflections, you know, it looks like, boy, you could fly right through there. It looks like a tunnel. So whatever you can do to deaden those reflections, or put some bird netting hanging down in front of the window so that they can't hit the glass, that's all helpful as far as bird conservation. But it is a problem when we attract birds around our homes. But most people are willing to take that risk because of the benefits, both to the people involved and to the birds in terms of the feeding. So I think
the other question was the thistle feeder.
What they're poking around there, whether they that's exploratory in terms of, I don't know what color, if there's some color involved in that feeder. Sometimes they're just attracted to explore the color. I've had them come down when I'm working in the garden and have a bright color on, and they'll come right up and buzz up. So, oh, look at the size of that red flower. And then realize the error in their ways and move on. So I can't answer that one. Mm.
But thank you very much for calling. All good questions. Rosalind?
Okay, thank you. And you don't know where they go.
Oh, where do they go?
And do they stop on the way is what I was wondering.
Oh.
Sure. Most birds don't make these long migrations in one fell swoop. They'll move usually often at night and stop and rest and feed and so forth. But the hummingbirds are quite capable of making the flight across the Gulf of Mexico and so forth. And it's hard to imagine how that little tiny bit of energy could power that bird to make those long flights, but they do. Early on, when people were trying to explain bird migration, one of the myths was that hummingbirds actually hitched a ride on the backs of larger birds that were going in the same basic direction, but that was later proven to be incorrect. But they're quite capable of doing it on their own, and they do stop periodically, except, of course, when they're traveling over open water.
Yeah, and sometimes they'll actually drop on ships. They've been reported as landing on ships that were going across the Gulf, or even their oil derricks out there. They'll land on those and maybe get a little rest before they take off again. So there's, and as to where they go, they're across
from,
the Gulf.
From the southern parts of this country all the way down into the
southern,
in Central America.
Central America, absolutely. Thanks for calling, Rosalind. Appreciate it. And let's see, we've got some more callers. Sarah in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. We have been lucky enough to have a hummingbird come and build a nest and have babies in one of our trees in our front yard every year for like the past 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, do they come back to the same place every year? She tends to build the nest on the same branch of the same tree,
mm-hmm.
if it isn't there from the year before. And I thought that was the weirdest thing. I had never seen a hummingbird nest or anything before we moved there. So that's my question.
Many birds are quite faithful to their nest site. I mean, literally down to the same limb, same bush, and so forth. And in addition to migration in general, that ability to home to a very particular spot on the landscape is just another one of those great wonders in terms of birds moving around the landscape.
Yeah,
yeah, it's amazing.
Do you have Do you have some good photos?
We have a couple photos. Yeah, it's amazing how small the nest is.
Well, the nest is small. The eggs are small, and the birds are small.
Yeah. We haven't even seen the birds. We've seen the eggs, but then we've seen the mom try to feed the birds, but they were so small that we couldn't really get a good look at them.
Oh, cool.
Maybe next year.
Thanks, Sarah.
And another thing I wanted to say about Roslyn asking where they went, I was in West Texas once during their migration, and it was amazing. I was at a county park in the middle of nowhere, and they had bleachers set up with, like, facing a bunch of hummingbird feeders, and there were just hundreds of them. It was amazing. It was really cool to see.
Oh.
And that's it.
Thank you, Sarah.
Have a good day.
Yep, you too. Great stories. Thank you. Wenzel in Amherst. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. It's Scott. Enjoy the show whenever I get time to listen. I've just been informed we have a woods in Waupaca County, and there's a real primitive shelter there. And I've been informed that there's a bear kind of traversing the property that has its den on the adjacent in the adjacent woods, and I, you just go out there hit and miss, and now we have this grandson and everything, a couple years old, and I just wonder if there's any cause for concern about that sort of situation.
Well, it's a commonly asked question when it comes to bears and wolves and other large animals, but despite the fact that there are many, many bears in Wisconsin and many times as many people, we have relatively few bear people interactions, and bear human interactions that end poorly are even more unusual. So the bottom line is the risk is fairly small, very small. But if you're nervous about it, there are some good sources of information. There's a website called Be Bear Aware, and there's literature out by both the DNR and the Forest Service on living around black bears and how you should respond if you encounter them. But I would just say that today is the 5th of September, and that's the opening day of the bear hunting season. And that will also cause a major change in bear behavior as they are being pursued by hunters now for the next up until into early October, I believe.
Yeah.
So it's quite possible that that bear you're concerned about may relocate and may be a little scarcer, a little harder to find now that hunting season is open.
Hmm.
Okay, so like you say, just get some real good information on the internet and then...
Yeah, that DNR site.
Yeah, the in terms of what to do if you actually come in contact with the bear, and if you're concerned about the kids, are kids out there on their own, or are they always with you?
No, it'd be always supervised.
Yeah, so in that case, you don't necessarily need to be passing that along, but it's certainly good to have the kids understand that there are bears and other animals in the woods that they need to be interested in and not necessarily afraid of, but just know they're there and know that the animals deserve a little respect and how to behave when you're around those animals. And that can be anything from a black bear to a yellow jacket's nest this time of year. Kids need to know about that kind of thing so they can avoid problems.
Yep. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I'm going to go back to the loon topic for a minute. Remember we were talking about the caller who had loons on a 25-acre or so lake. Jeff, a loon researcher, called to say that the loon sighting was probably the case of surface rushing behavior, a territorial aggression to decide which loons will get to have that territory next year.
Hmm. Well, I mean, they are pretty territorial, and that's I think the caller mentioned there were four or five loons that they were seeing. So if one pair had staked that out and decided that they didn't want interlopers, then that chasing behavior or surface rushing would be a good explanation. So thanks, Jeff, for passing that along.
Mm-hmm. And Sarah in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I was up north last weekend and saw a mother deer and two really small Bambi-looking fawns. They still had their spots.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Are deers also having a second batch of fawns this year? And no. Will fawns this young make it through the winter?
No second batch in the case of deer. The gestation period, which is a couple hundred days, is too long. So the breeding activity is in the fall. The peak of fawn births is around June 1st, but there's a distribution of fawn births from remarkably early spring until surprisingly late summer. So I think that was just probably a late breeding and a late couple of fawns, and they are starting, the older ones are starting to lose their spots and grow rather quickly, but there's a pretty good chance we're still pretty early, and I mean, fall hasn't really even started yet, so a pretty good chance they'll be just fine.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for calling. We have Gary in Kenosha with a question. Hi, Gary.
Hello. CWD question related and comment. I was reading about this poison hemlock, which is an invasive plant species. I can't remember where it came from. But according to what I was reading, livestock will eat this poison hemlock, and then it has almost a narcotic effect, so they'll seek it out again. And then if the animal is pregnant, then when the calves or the fawns are born, calves in this case, they said, they exhibit what to me seemed like symptoms almost of that chronic wasting disease. Do you think there could be any correlation in that, you know, aspect?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there are a variety of things that animals sometimes get into that cause behavioral changes, or, you know, even birds eating fermented fruit in the fall exhibit behavior of intoxication and so forth. So animals are generally pretty adept at picking out things that are toxic in the environment and avoiding them. But the chronic wasting disease issue that's related to a prion, an abnormality in the animal, it takes a long time to develop. Takes a long time to kill the animal when it's infected. I don't think there's any particular link there. Unfortunately, we'd sure like to know more about chronic wasting disease and where it might have come from, but I don't think anyone's suggesting that there's any link to plant toxins or anything like that.
Just recently, an article in the last day or so here on chronic wasting disease.
Yeah, there was a big spread in the State Journal. Apparently it was online in the Sunday paper, and then it was in the State Journal this morning, and it was entitled, "The State Has Pretty Much Abandoned CWD Containment Efforts. Now What?" And there have been a couple of editorials by some of the outdoor writers like Pat Durkin, largely in response to the governor canceling the October antlerless deer hunt, particularly in the CWD area, and some people have taken that to perhaps indicate the first step in a retrenchment on the campaign to dramatically reduce the deer herd as the primary means of attempting to stem both the spread and the prevalence of CWD. This article this morning was based on a conversation with a colleague of mine here at the university, Dr. Mike Samuel in the Co-op Wildlife Research Unit. And Mike was talking primarily about how this notion of the change in the October hunt in the article actually should have said that Mike's comments were specifically related to the demise of the October hunt and the fact that that probably didn't make a huge amount of difference in the fight against CWD. But his central premise in the article was that there is some new research coming out fairly soon, we hope, that suggests that there may be hopefully some alternative strategies to this notion of herd reduction, which, as you know, Larry, we've been embroiled in since 2002 with relatively little to show for it. So I think hunter frustration, landowner frustration over those many years now, without much to show for it, are probably what led to the governor's cancellation of that hunt. But that was only one of a number of hunts that were implemented to reduce the herd in the chronic waste disease area. And the rest, the holiday hunt and a variety of others, are still in place. So while this is a move in that direction, it's certainly not a I don't view it as a major step one way or the other. And it was something that was called for in the Deer Czar's report, as we call it, Kroll's report to the DNR, that people in that area were looking to see an easing up of the regulations. So
no big deal,
but it's optimistic to think that there is some new research that may point to some things to try that may be more successful than this herd reduction has been. So
hopefully down the road we'll have a chance to talk about that.
We can only hope.
Scott Craven, UW Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Thank you for listening in today. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show. There's some really great information here on that. The black animal that the truck driver saw. We've had a listener, Jan, did a little work for me. She, according to the Maryland DNR, fishers are making a comeback there after having pretty much been wiped out. And Jan sent a link to their DNR site. So I'm pretty sure it's got to be a fisher.
Had the sighting been in Wisconsin, we'd have gone there in the first place. But I think we're a little tainted, Larry, by so many years of people describing large, long-tailed animals and wanting to go in the direction of big cats, namely cougars, that that's the path we chose early on. But knowing now that fishers are making a comeback in Maryland, I would certainly, based on the leg length and the bushy tail and all, I think it was a fisher.
And here from Tom, I have a successful bat house by Cumberland. Will the bats overwinter in the house? I want to install another house, but don't want to disturb the bats.
It's great that he has a successful bat house. It's become a very popular thing to do, and occupancy rates are not 100%, but he's got bats, so that's great, but they won't overwinter in the bat house. They're going to clear out of there, and whether they go to a nearby hibernaculum or somebody's attic or a mine or a cave or a rock formation or essentially head south, depending on the type of bat that's in there, once we've had a frost and those bats clear out, he's free to do whatever he wants with that house or add new ones or anything else. But bat houses are not an overwinter situation in Wisconsin.
Does give us a chance to talk about a friend and someone who's been a guest on this program and certainly a friend of yours as well, Dave Riddell. He was one of your students.
He was a master's student with me, and he did some great work as a student with bats, and he's been doing terrific bat work ever since. And I was very pleased to see in a news release just a day or so ago that the United States Fish and Wildlife Service had presented Dave, and apparently they sent representatives out here from Washington to present Dave with the Silver Eagle Award. Basically, that's the Fish and Wildlife Service's highest honor to an individual for outstanding contributions to wildlife conservation and management. And Dave is certainly deserving of that. He's really put bats on the map in Wisconsin, and it's fantastic. It's just good news and well-deserved, and our congratulations go out to Dave for that award.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike in Seneca, it's your turn. Thank you for waiting. Hi.
Yes, I almost hung up. Regarding a time or two ago, what Scott was talking about, the problem with people are feeding wildlife and this and that. Here's a classic. I never saw this happen before. I was at a large industrial complex, and the mechanic, there was a big dock with an overhang, and they had bird netting on it so birds couldn't get up there and get trapped and poo on everybody coming and going and this and that. So this mechanic comes in with a hummingbird in his hand, and he walks through the plant and goes over to the foreman's office and asks the foreman what he should do with that. And pretty soon there's six people in his office, and the thing was just about dead. I happened to be in there getting doing some business, and this little bird was in his hand, and his eyes were blinking, but he couldn't get up. He was so weak because it was a hot summer day. And anyway, the foreman says he was drinking a can of 7-Up, and he hear the foreman sitting at his desk on his secretarial chair, and six employees standing around watching the foreman with an eyedropper feeding the bird 7-Up. It literally perked up. And then he got it to sit on a pencil, and he was blinking its eyes and opening its mouth and enjoying that
seven up
type of nectar, you know. And then, of course, it was revived. I mean, this took about 20 minutes, and then they let it go. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Those are the kinds of feel-good things that people do with wildlife of all kinds. It just makes everybody feel really good for a while. So I certainly urge people to get involved when human intervention is necessary, and in this case it certainly was. So it's a good story that ended well for all concerned.
Thanks, Mike.
Sure.
Appreciate the call. Someone else, I think on our Facebook page, there was somebody was wondering why hummingbirds get into his garage. And I don't have it right here in front of me at the moment, but why they get into his garage and then they can't seem to get out, even though there's this big wide door wide open, they just don't seem to be able to get out.
Well, I think anything that gets trapped like that, even things like big dragonflies or some of the larger moths or whatever, especially if there are windows in the garage and they figure that's the way out, they'll just incessantly bang up against that window trying to get out. But eventually, especially with a little encouragement, they'll find that door and get out.
Dan in Sun Prairie, hello.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm calling from Star Prairie, and I have a home on Cedar Lake. And I have what appears to be maybe two families of hummingbirds. A couple of them are extremely territorial.
They don't care for each other. They don't play well together.
They don't play well together.
No.
There'll be three or four birds feeding at my feeder, and another one will come along, and it seems like, I'm not sure if it's a male, I think it's a female, you know, chases that strange one away, and I thought by putting up another feeder that would help, and it just doesn't. They want to go to the one feeder. And it could be the quality of the second feeder. I'm not sure. But even when there's a second feeder up, they will not allow this other group to come unless everyone's gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. They are very territorial, and they're very aggressive toward interlopers or other birds in the same area. But that's one of the things that makes a hummingbird feeder fairly attractive, because if you've got a lot of hummers, it's just a melee of activity as they're zooming in and out and chasing each other around, and it makes for a lot more interesting viewing than if they all just kind of lined up on the perches and sedately drank their nectar and then moved off. So this aggressive behavior does add a little bit to the excitement.
Yeah, sure does.
It is a little bit exciting, and there seem to be somewhere around 5 to 7 birds that are hanging in the neighborhood. Another question I have I'm on a lake that's about 1,100 acres, and there are two... Well, there's a lot of wildlife this year. There are two families of eagles, and there are two sets of loons that have been around for the last 2 years. And, in fact, there even seem to be 5 loons on this lake. Now, I always read, I think I remember reading, that there was typically one pair of loons per lake, although this is a larger lake, so I wondered
if you get to larger lakes, especially lakes that have islands or bays or peninsulas or the other than bowl shaped, where the loons can gain some spatial separation, you can have multiple pairs on large lakes. Most of the large lakes, the UW field station is on a large lake in the Minocqua chain, and there are a number of pairs on that large lake.
Yeah, it's been a wonderful year for wildlife on Cedar Lake, and we've all been enjoying it. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad there's something good about this long, hot, dry weather, because personally, I'm really looking forward to the end of it and the onset of fall. It was great to get a good rain last night. I'm afraid it's too late to help many of the vegetative issues, but it just made everything feel a lot better.
A great picture on my Facebook page. A friend posted this week, a friend of the person who posted it, Kat, said a fledgling that lives in her backyard. Is it unusual for hawks to have fledglings this time of year? You had to guess, would you say this is a Harris or sharp shin?
Well, not Harris, not around here, but I can't tell from the size there. When you get into the three, the sharp shin, the Cooper's hawk, and the goshawk, they're almost identical except for size. And I have nothing as a frame of reference in there. If it's a small bird, not a whole lot bigger than a blue jay or a mourning dove, then sharp shinned. If it's bigger than that, then Cooper's. So I can't tell from that picture, Larry.
Well, I'll tell you what, we've got another issue for you, Scott, because this one comes from James in Hillsboro. Thinks you need to come to Vernon County to investigate a Sasquatch Bigfoot sighting that was reported to police.
Well, very interesting, and I would like, I've been very interested in the Sasquatch situation. I've concluded my investigations into the Loch Ness Monster, and it's time to move on to something else. Actually, that's interesting. I don't know if you saw it in the paper just a few days ago. Some guy was trying to fool around in a Sasquatch suit, which I checked on the internet, mm-hmm. and you can rent any number of Sasquatch suits. And we should maybe come back and catch this a little later, because the guy was run over and killed by a car trying to pull a prank.
Oh!
And I had been urged to do that, so it made me a little nervous.
Scott Craven, our guest, he'll be with us till 12:30. You know, one of the great things about the state of Wisconsin is the abundance of wildlife that we have. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing about our state, and there are so many great opportunities to observe wildlife. Sometimes it's not very pleasant when they're maybe doing something to your garden, but there are a lot of other times. Most times, it's just a real joy. Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist, our guest today to talk about the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. You can join in with a question or comment at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, but go to my Facebook page. Go to The Larry Mueller Show. That's the name of the page, The Larry Mueller Show. Post a question or a photograph there. I'd love to see that. Click like while you're there, and we'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be back right after the news. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we talk the world of wildlife with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. Questions for Scott, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Post a question or a comment there. And Terry in Green Bay has been waiting a while, Scott, so let's go there. Terry, hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi there, Scott and Larry. I just want to make a comment and then ask Scott a question about chipmunks. The comment is, to your listeners, don't let your cats run. What Scott was discussing earlier, I mean, out here I have 20 acres and I got problems all the time with cats, and I deal with them, believe me. And on the question with chipmunks, Scott, do they go into more of a less active movement, feeding and everything at this time of the year? I don't see many of my chipmunks out a lot now.
I think everything has been somewhat stymied, with the exception of 13-line ground squirrels, which had a banner year. There were ground squirrels everywhere, in the garden, in the prairie, in the lawn, and all over the place, and they remain very active. They like hot, sunny weather. But I think some of the other things, especially things that spend their time in burrows and whatnot, if they were anything like me, this has not been a good summer to be very active. Bone dry, of course, and extremely hot, and I think that just suppressed a fair bit of animal activity. But given the boom in ground squirrels, I have to assume the chipmunk population is doing okay as well. And with the relatively good nut crop this fall and cooler weather, I think you might see a little more resurgence of chipmunk activities before they disappear for the season.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. I had an email earlier, and I'm trying to locate it. It has to do with the wolf issue, and it has to do with the wolves and dogs. And I must have gotten erased. It is the issue was, will dogs really, if you know, get be harmed by wolves if there's a if they're chased, if they're trained to hunt wolves, if there's a fight between a wolf and a dog, probably the wolf is going to be the winner.
So I guess this is speaking to the issue here where the wolf hunt has been derailed, at least temporarily, by the judge's ruling that responded to the suit brought forward that the use of dogs should be removed from the hunting scene. And this is kind of one of those emotional things that we can say, gee, really don't know for sure because we don't have any track record here, but we don't have any track record in the Wisconsin wolf hunt at all. So a hunt plan was put in place based on what the legislature mandated. It included the ability to use dogs to run these animals, and that will probably, if it ever happens, would prove to be the most effective technique for actually harvesting a wolf. And there's some evidence from other states that wolves will run from a dog rather than essentially baying up and confronting the dogs, and that the hunting using dogs would proceed much like coyote hunting, where the hunters are trying to get out in front of the wolf being run by the dogs and intercepted at a crossing, open space, road, or whatever. All that may be a moot point if it's not allowed, but the... So I guess the response is, what would happen? Gee, I don't know for sure. I can imagine that in 100 incidences of people running wolves with dogs, perhaps 99 of them end up with either the wolf being harvested or the wolf escaping without any harm to the dogs. But if there is an incident where dogs are killed or injured in a confrontation with wolves, then I think that would be used as... rather quickly as fodder that, gee, this wasn't a good idea. However, we need to, I think in the discussion, you need to consider the fact that dogs are trained to hunt a lot of animals, including some potentially dangerous ones like bears and mountain lions in the West and other species around the countryside and around the world. And if the dogs are trained properly, they've become they are a very important tool in some types of hunting. So bottom line is, where this is headed, I don't know. Wolves are certainly capable of killing dogs, as you point out, if there's a confrontation. And quite a number of dogs have been killed incidentally by wolves since the wolf population has bounced back as effectively as it has. But currently, at least as far as I know, we're under the halt in the hunt plans that the judge ordered last week, and I don't know what's going to happen. I was with one of the DNR folks on Saturday in a bit of a field exercise, and we were saying, hey, what's going to happen here? And it's a tight spot for the agency people to be in. On the one hand, the judge is saying, hey, you can go ahead and hunt wolves, but you better have a sticker on the license that says no dogs allowed. And the legislature's coming in, that's coming in one window, and in the other window, the legislative direction is, well, you're going to have a wolf hunt, and it's going to include dogs. So what's a person to do? And that's where the last I heard, just 3 days ago or 4 days ago, that's where the dilemma stood. They extended, because of some of the confusion, they extended the application process for another week. I think it closes soon if it hasn't already. Last I heard, there were at least 18,000 applicants who wanted the chance at a wolf harvest permit, and there's probably more than that now. So I don't know where it's going to go, Larry. The dog issue is a difficult one, and it's an emotional one, but that could be a very effective harvest technique that might be taken out of the toolbox.
Timberwolf Alliance reports 22 hunting dogs were in conflicts with wolves in Wisconsin in 2011. So that might have been from bear or whatever.
Well, that could be a matter of hounds running bears. It could be a matter of somebody out with their bird dog, or
it could
be somebody's pet. So I think since they started to track these things and actually pay damages, the last figure I saw was somewhere in the neighborhood of 250 plus or minus dogs that have been killed by in Wisconsin over the years by wolves. But none of those, of course, were actually dogs pursuing wolves, as far as I know.
Right. Let's go to Mark in Dubuque, Iowa next. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Scott. How you doing?
Good.
Good. Listen, I tell you what. I got a quick question for you. I live right in the middle of town in Dubuque, Iowa. And the wife and I, we feed our birds and have quite a few birds and stuff. During the summer, late at night, right at dusk, early nighttime, heard a bird noise that I was not familiar with, and it's I believe it's the common nighthawk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was just wondering, can you tell me just a little bit about that bird? It was around for about 2 or 3 weeks. Now it's not around. I've never seen it, and I was just wondering what its habitat is. Is it nomadic, territorial?
First of all, Mark, what makes you think it was a nighthawk?
Well, we heard the noise. We heard the bird noise, and so the wife and I got on the internet and did a lot of just checking and checking and checking, going through things, and we heard a video or audio on that noise, on that bird noise, and I was just wondering. Is it a nighthawk? Is it common around this area?
Well, yes, they're reasonably common, although I don't hear nearly as many of them here as I used to when I lived on the East Coast, and they were actually quite common around towns and urban areas where you'd hear them. You'd hear them as they were flying in the evening and around dark when they were feeding. They're insect feeders. They fly and swoop high in the sky. They're fairly... a moderate-sized bird, but rather frail-looking, look and are closely related to whippoorwills, which, if you heard those, you'd know the whippoorwill call. So I assume we're talking about nighthawks as opposed to whippoorwills. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. There'll be big migrations of them come the onset of fall here, where they'll gather in large groups, and you just see them drifting off to the south. How common they are in your area, I can't really tell you, but I think any local nature center or bird club could probably indicate that. But so the sound you heard appeared to be coming from the sky, is that correct?
Well, yeah, actually what, in the evening, it would, they'd be flying around. You couldn't see it, but you could hear it in different, locations around the property.
Yeah, the call that they make is when they're flying, and they're often fairly high in the sky, and they swoop and dart, and they're not a really big bird, so they're not that easy to see if you don't know what you're looking for. But that all makes sense in terms of what you identified as the sound. But how common they are in your area, that I can't say much about.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Stevens Point, hi to you.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I got my cards out of my trail cameras, and I've got two different bucks on the land that seem to be having tumors growing out of their face, legs, and back, black hairless tumors.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of pasta-shaped. I'm just wondering what that is and if they're going to be any good to shoot.
I doubt that has anything to do with the edibility or quality of the meat, but I think if you there are a couple of possible explanations, but I'm just trying to think of the easiest way to steer you to reference where you can see some of these problems that deer face and pick out what you've got. How are we going to do this?
That's a good
question. I'm just trying to think of some of the references. There's a really a big book from the Wildlife Management Institute called The White-Tailed Deer. It's Ecology and Management that has a section on diseases, parasites, and the like in it, a chapter, and there are some pretty good illustrations you could look at there I'm just trying to think if there's anything readily available from the National Wildlife Health Center. I'm guessing if you go online and do a little Google work with white-tailed deer and diseases, tumors, that search on that kind of thing, that you'll end up with some pictures that will help you pin down what you're seeing. But my guess is that that probably does not affect the edibility issue.
You think it's a caused by an insect or?
No, they are prone. There are a couple. Where are the tumors on the face? Are they near the base of the antlers at all?
No, it's more towards the mouth and the eyes.
Okay.
Towards the snout.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm just drawing a blank on recalling the specific problem and then facial tumors. And there's another problem that affects bucks at kind of the base of the antlers too. But I think if you do a little Google work, or potentially get in touch with, where were you calling from? Oh, from Stevens Point. Call a local DNR office and see if they can put you in touch with the wildlife health specialist in Madison. And I'm guessing that they can probably fill you in on the specifics of what you're seeing.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's an issue as far as harvesting the deer and utilizing it.
Okay. Good luck. Thank you for calling, Steve. Philip in West Bend. Hi.
How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
I, too, just pulled my cards out of the game cameras, and I got a short, built like a rock animal running around. I think it's a wolverine, but it's up in Taylor County. Is it possible that there's wolverines running around over there, or is it something else? It's got to be, I don't know, 5-6 inch long legs on it, real long snout, not a real long snout, but a pointy snout and black-tipped ears.
Hmm. Well, it's not certainly not likely to be a wolverine.
All right.
That's a pretty big animal, and I don't think, although there have been occasional records of wolverines in Wisconsin in recent years, they were all traced to escapes, releases, and so forth. So wild wolverine, not likely by a long shot. I'm just trying to think of other short, stout animals with a pointed, not a fisher.
No, I'm a bear hunter, and I got millions of fishers.
Not a badger?
Nope, it doesn't have the markings like a badger.
So no.
And the tail on it's only, I'd say, 6 inches long.
What color is it?
It's a nice picture, so it's more of a black and gray picture. But it's a defined picture. It's a great picture of it.
Well, email it to us, and we'll sort it out for you. Send it to Larry.
I'll hang up and listen for the email. I'm in a car right now, so.
Yeah, I think you can get it to Larry's. We've had lots of good pictures sent in on Larry's Facebook page for the program, and that's the easiest way for us to make the identification. Built low to the ground, I mean, you start thinking about wolverine, no. Badger, no. Woodchuck, probably not out at night, not a pointy nose. Skunk, you would have identified.
Right.
You know, we quickly run through the likely candidates, so it would be very helpful if we could see the picture.
Okay. Yeah,
okay.
It's got some pretty decent shoulders on it. I mean, if you corner it, it's going to get you.
Okay.
Thanks, Phil.
All right. Thanks.
Yep. Bye-bye. And Beth in Green Bay. Hi, Beth.
Yes. Hello. My question concerns cowbirds. You know, they lay their eggs in other bird species' nests. How do they know they're cowbirds? How come they're not imprinted on their host species? And how do they find each other?
Wait a minute, say that again. So the young cowbird hatches, and how does it know it's not a goldfinch or a warbler or whatever else?
Yeah, well, I've always wondered about that. Why aren't they imprinted on the whole species? And then, you know, how do they find each other to reproduce this behavior?
They're a flocking bird like all the members of the blackbird group are. I think once they've eliminated the competition of the other young in the songbird nest, the only use for the parent songbird is to get them fed and raised to the point that they can fly, and then they're off, and at that point it must be innate recognition that, hey, I'm a cowbird, and this is the way I need to make my living, and this is who I need to consort with.
Okay. Yeah, I just think so many birds are so easily imprinted different species that you just, you know, even on humans.
Well, that's a very interesting question, actually. I've never heard the question before, but it is an interesting thought process. Hey, you know, you were raised in a nest with whatever songbird,
yeah.
And how do you go back to figuring out your cowbird? I'm gonna ask a couple of my ornithologist buddies about that and see what they have to say.
All right.
We'll report back.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. You know, there's some anniversaries this year, Scott, that I think is worth talking about. One in particular, the 75th anniversary of Ducks Unlimited.
Yep, there were a number we mentioned on the last program. I mean, Ducks Unlimited, the Pittman Robertson program that raises all this money for wildlife conservation, the forming of the Wildlife Society. This was a big year for lots, or I guess 1937 was a big year for lots of things. But for folks interested in these various species-specific conservation groups, Ducks Unlimited just came out with their special 75th anniversary issue of the magazine, and I was looking at it the other day, and it is... For this particular organization, the tens of thousands or millions of acres of wetland and other wildlife habitat, particularly wetland habitat, that DU has raised money for at their banquets and at their other fundraising techniques over the years is really incredible.
Yeah.
And their commitment looking toward the future to conserve millions of additional acres, especially up in Canada, is also impressive. And the commitment of their supporters is especially impressive. And what took is the 75th anniversary. So they've been attempting to raise additional funding for these initiatives. And in the magazine, it discusses three individual donors, one anonymous, two are identified in the magazine, who stepped up and pledged $25 million apiece to raise $75 million for the 75th anniversary and allow DU to move forward with their conservation initiatives. Fantastic credit both to the organization and to people who have the resources to make that kind of a commitment to benefit conservation, but it also speaks to all the other groups that are around here,
yeah,
in southern Wisconsin or anywhere in the country, whether it's Ducks Unlimited or the Rough Grouse Society, the Wild Turkey Federation, Whitetails Unlimited. There are dozens of them. If you're interested in conservation and you're looking for some way to give back, join some of these groups, help them raise some money, and they're doing great things for conservation that our agency simply can't do. So,
yeah.
Neat deal.
Neat deal. We had a Facebook question from Jerry. You talked about purple loosestrife last time you were on. He's worried about Phragmites. It seems to be taking over all the cattails in his area.
Well, that's whether it's Phragmites or purple loosestrife or garlic mustard or any one of a host of invasive plants. It's a constant struggle to try and keep these under control. And the DNR and various conservation groups are doing all they can, but there's a lot of them out there like Phragmites that need some attention. So there's just another example where individuals, hey, I'm concerned about this. Okay, well, take your concern and translate it into action and find out who's out there pulling plants or spraying plants or doing any of the other control techniques and help out.
And another Facebook question from Kyle had to do with the rusty crayfish. He hasn't heard anything much about that lately, and that was, of course, a big concern.
Well, it still is, and they've got a variety of techniques that they're still trying in some of the experimental sites in the Northwoods to keep rusty crayfish under control, but they're still out there. I think they've just been pushed to the back burner by so many other societal and natural history concerns right now.
And a funny email from Robert who thought his tomatoes and peppers and squash and beans are being eaten up by squirrels and chipmunks, and recently he witnessed a muskrat wriggle under the fence, and that seems to be the problem in his garden, a muskrat.
You need to do your homework so you're blaming the right culprit for these problems.
We had a muskrat on our Lake Monona home, too, that he would come up and get into the garden, and he pretty much eliminated our flowers. He was...
Well, essentially a muskrat is just a gigantic vole, so that tells you where their interests lie.
it surely does. Well, I tell you what, Scott, we got fall migration underway. We're about running out of time here, but here's another answer on the deer warts. Donna in Madison Sinks.
Yes, fibromas.
Fibromas, cutaneous fibromas, were more commonly called warts. They're smooth, black to gray, hairless tumors caused by a virus. Can be single, multiple, or in clumps. Although they can be found anywhere on a deer, they're more common on the head, neck, and shoulders, caused by a virus.
There you have it.
I tell you what, if we if we don't have the answer ourselves, just wait a couple minutes and somebody
will come up with it.
Scott, always a pleasure. We'll see you next month.
Yes, I'll be here.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. He will be back on the first Wednesday of next month, and we will do that all over again. Just looking ahead to shows that are coming up, tomorrow at 11, Peter Green of InfoStar is here to help us with our personal computers, talk about what personal information is publicly available on the Internet, plus Pete's top 10 list for websites for the month. And again, go to my Facebook page. Lots of great photos from today. Click on the Larry Mailer Show. Click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates. We'll be back. Thank you for listening. Stay with us.